Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about issues of the day from a biblical perspective, as well as highlights from interviews, conferences, and events. Here's Monty Larrick.
Thanks for making Illinois Family Spotlight part of your day, featuring Allie Beth Stuckey's keynote address at the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet. Ms. Stuckey is a wife, mother, author, and host of the critically acclaimed Relatable podcast. During this segment, she explains that politics and policy matter because people matter.
I graduated from college in South Carolina. I moved to Athens, Georgia. I started a job in PR there, and I started leading a Bible study of young women who were freshmen in college, and it was around the election time, 2015, 2016, if you can remember how contentious that time was. And of course, for these young women, this was their first time voting, their first time really paying attention to what was going on. These were good girls. These were smart young women. And actually, one of the smartest young women in the group, one of the most biblically literate young women that I had met. As we were talking about the election going into 2015, she said to me one night, "I love Bernie Sanders." And I thought, uh-oh. I've got a problem here. Okay, so as I started to engage her on the issues, as I said, a very knowledgeable person, but she had really been misled about the issues and what really matters and how to approach these things from a biblical perspective. As I started talking to her about things not just like socialism, but also about issues like abortion, I realized that she just hadn't really considered what the Bible had to say about this. She did what a lot of Christians or professing Christians unfortunately do. She compartmentalized her faith from her politics, and she bought into the lie that the compassionate approach is to outsource our compassion to the government. And the more I talked to her, the more I talked to these young women in my Bible study, the more I realized how much I loved it. How much I loved engaging with these young people. And so even as I had my full-time job, I started reaching out to sororities. As I said, I lived in Athens, Georgia. This is a college town, the University of Georgia. And after I met my husband and got married, I really wanted to scratch this itch of public speaking. I'm super weird. I love to public speak. I've always loved to public speak. And I wanted to combine this love for talking about politics and culture from a Christian perspective with my desire to public speak. So I started touring the sorority houses on Millage Avenue. I would give my presentation about what the issues are, how they're at stake, why they matter, what the different candidates represent. Then I started writing about these things. I started blogging about them. I started posting on social media about them back in the time before the heavy censorship that we deal with now, where you could say something and if people liked it, they would actually see it and would be able to share it. So it was a good time. And then, of course, it grew into what I do today. Relatable started in 2018, and the Lord has just been so kind and so gracious. And I still, more than ever, am passionate about talking to people, not just college students, but people of all kinds, but especially Christians, about why the so-called culture war and why this political, seemingly, battle that we're in really matters. And why I use words like so-called and why I say seemingly is because ultimately we as Christians know that the battle is spiritual. Ultimately, we know that these so-called culture war problems are primarily theological. They're primarily biblical issues. They're not only biblical issues, they are Genesis issues. And not only that, but they are Genesis 1 issues. And not only that, when you really think about it, they're Genesis 1:1 issues, that God created the heavens and the earth. Because if he is the creator of it, then he is the authority over all of it. He is the definer of all things. He says what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is bad, what is true, what is false, when a life begins, what a woman is and what it's not. And he very clearly answers these cultural questions, what have become these cultural and political questions, in that very first chapter of the first book of the Bible. That's how much they matter. It's like he knew, okay, one day y'all are going to have a Supreme Court nominee that cannot define what a woman is. Let me help you out. I'm going to put it right here. And the first chapter of the Bible in Genesis 1:27, a verse that's so foundational and so extremely clear. That God created them in his image. In his image, he created them male and female. He created them. So right there, we see what God thinks about abortion, about gender, and about marriage. Because we are made in his image from the time that we are human. So that is the moment of fertilization that we have our own distinct DNA. So we are made in God's image. Therefore, we have innate value and we matter. We see the definition of gender right there, male, female, that's the binary, no confusion about it. We see the definition of marriage and family, male and female, he brings them together and says to be fruitful and multiply. So there is absolutely no reason for the Christian to be confused about these things. We are told that they're controversial. We're told that they're controversial. We're told that they're contentious. We're told that representing these foundational truths is unloving. But God is love. That's 1 John 4:8. And if God is love, then he alone gets to say what love is. And again, God is so gracious and so good to define these terms for us. And God defines love in 1 Corinthians 13. He gives many qualities of it, but one of the qualities that he gives for love in 1 Corinthians 13:6 is that love rejoices with the truth. That means for the Christian, we understand that love, true love, not the superficial love that the world defines, but true love defined by the God who is love, who characterizes love, is inextricably intertwined with the truth. And the only place that we can find ultimate truth is in the truth of God's word. So saying what is good, right, and true according to the Bible, while the world sees this as hate, while the world sees this as bigotry, while the world defines this as lacking empathy or lacking compassion, the truth is we cannot outlove God. And the most loving thing we can always do is agree with him. And when we say what God's word says about these cultural questions, we are being as loving as we possibly can. You know, a lot of Christians have convinced themselves to become apathetic about politics, to not care really what's going on in the culture. And look, I understand that temptation. Sometimes I certainly, in talking about all of the things that I do and consuming the news, I easily get fatigued. And there are some times where I want to disengage and I want to step back. And so I understand that many Christians feel like it just doesn't matter that Jesus is coming back, that he is going to claim ultimate victory. So why do these culture war questions and political battles really have significance today? And while it is absolutely true, yes and amen, that Jesus is coming back one day, he is not here yet. He is not here yet. And right now, we occupy this temporal, physical context, not arbitrarily or accidentally, but purposely and providentially. You and I were placed here, as are our children and our children's children, by a God who does nothing by accident, by a God who does everything with intention, everything with purpose. We occupy this tiny spot on eternity, this tiny speck of the universe for a reason. And that reason is to glorify God and to make the world around us, this tiny plot of earth, better. And one way that we do that, it's not the exclusive way, it may not even be the primary way, but one way that we do that is through politics. This is an alliteration. If you watch Relatable, you know exactly what I'm about to say. this alliteration I have been using for several years. I thought, what is an easy way to get people to understand why politics really does matter, why we shouldn't disengage? And here it is. Politics matter because policy matters because people matter. Politics affects policy. Politics affects policy. Policy affects people, and people matter. People matter to God who created them, and people matter to us. And policy has a real effect on their lives.
Author and podcast host Ali Beth Stuckey during the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet. Now, after time out, we'll continue with her keynote remarks in which she says politics matter because lives are on the line.
This is Seth Liebson for townhall.com. Last week, rallygoers at a Wisconsin rally proclaimed, "Jesus is Lord." Vice President Kamala Harris responded,
"Oh, you guys are at the wrong rally. No, I think you meant to go to the smaller one down the street."
Liberal Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas once wrote, "We Americans are a religious people whose institutions presuppose a supreme being." Alexis de Tocqueville put it that religion is the first of our political institutions. Today, well over two-thirds of our country still identifies as Christian. Thank God. Curious, then, one of the major two parties in America has fielded a candidate for president in Kamala Harris who is so very anti-Christian. Perhaps that's the Democratic Party now, given its efforts to suppress so much religious expression, to go after religious charities and public outreach. In the past week, Kamala Harris also deliberately shunned the Al Smith dinner while mailing in a video mocking Catholicism. It's all a new level of Judeo-Christian insult. We should all be watching and listening to and taking this anti-Christianity seriously. Very. I'm Seth Liebson.
Thanks for joining this edition of Illinois Family Spotlight, featuring Ali Beth Stuckey's keynote address at the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet. During this segment of Spotlight, Ms. Stuckey explains that children today are bearing the brunt of bad social experiments, and she challenges Christians to counter them.
I think of this story that was told to me on my show, but I know this woman personally. She's a director of a pregnancy center in Texas, and they do amazing work, as do those of you who represent the pregnancy centers here in the Chicago area. I have been to many, many pro-life pregnancy centers across the country. What a beautiful manifestation of the hands and feet of Jesus, just loving some of the most vulnerable people. Yeah, you can applause for them. Absolutely. And this director was telling me a story of a young woman who walked in. She could barely speak English. This is a heavily Hispanic area. And she walked in and she tried to communicate that she was looking to have an abortion. She was pregnant. She was pregnant by an abusive man. She didn't want to keep the baby and she was looking for a way to have a free abortion. And she had already walked into Planned Parenthood that morning. And they told her, well, that'll be $800. They didn't offer her any other information, shock of all shocks. And she said, you know, I can't afford that. I can't afford $800. And so as she was searching on her phone where else she could go, praise the Lord, this pregnancy center came up in her search results. So she went there. And of course, instead of offering her an abortion, they offered her a sonogram. They offered her resources. They offered to try to get her prenatal vitamins and healthcare information about parenting and adoption. They shared the gospel with her, held her hand, looked her in the eye, and said, "You matter, and your baby matters, and we're here for you." She hadn't heard that before. She was alone. She felt like she had nowhere to turn and that the only option that she had was abortion. But she kept the baby. And she stayed in touch with this pregnancy center and the director of this pregnancy center, whose name is Leanne. And she asked Leanne, she said, "Can you be there with me, please, when I give birth?" And Leanne said, "Of course." One day it was close to her due date and she goes into the hospital with contractions and she calls Leanne and she says, "Please meet me at the hospital." But By the time Leanne gets there, there's a nurse that says, oh, we sent her home. We sent this patient home. It was false labor. She's not going into labor yet. So she went back to the pregnancy center, and because of the generosity of pro-life Christians, she has a whole closet filled with donations of things like cribs and diapers and wipes and car seats. And so she got a box of a new car seat, and she went to this young woman's apartment just to check on her and see if she was okay. And she knocked on the door, and she opened it, and this woman looked and she saw the car seat and she fell to her knees and she said, thank you. They told me I wouldn't be able to take my baby home if I didn't have a car seat. Leanne came inside, brought the car seat in. She looked around. She saw that this woman had nothing. Her refrigerator and pantry were almost empty. She didn't have the supplies that she needed to be able to have this little baby and take care of this baby. She was so poor. She wasn't able to afford these things. And she said to this woman, just wait here. I'm going to go get some friends from my church and from the pregnancy center. And when they come back, let them in because they're with me. And so Leanne left and did some things that she had to do. And her friends came to this apartment and they filled the refrigerator and the pantry with the groceries that she needed. They put together a crib for her, a rocking chair, filled the room with diapers and wipes. And when Leanne came back and brought her own set of supplies, this young woman looked at her and said, why are you doing this? Why are all of these people doing these things for me? I can't repay you. There is nothing that I can do. And Leanne was just able to tell her yet again, it is because of Jesus. It's because of Jesus that we are doing this for you. Because of what he's done for us, we get to love you and show you the grace that he has shown us. And right there, she gave her life to Christ. And a couple weeks later, she had her baby. And then a few months after she had her baby, this pregnancy center is attached to a big church in the area. It's called Prestonwood Baptist Church in Dallas. Many of you maybe have heard of it. It's a great church. And this woman started attending Prestonwood, and she wanted to dedicate her baby for baby dedication. And she didn't know any of this was going to happen, but of course the pastor knew this woman's story. And before she came on stage to have her baby dedicated during that service, the pastor just told the congregation a little bit about her story, just how she chose life, how she's courageous, how she's been able to get on her own two feet, and how Prestonwood Pregnancy Center had been able to give her the resources that she needed through the generosity of Christians. And as this woman who just about a year earlier thought that she had no one and nothing, just as she got onto the stage with her baby who could have been aborted just a few months earlier, the entire congregation stood up and gave her a standing ovation. And she stood there and sobbed. And yet again, she saw the love of Christ for her displayed through the lives of believers in the church. Now, why do I tell that story? What does that have to do with politics? Well, there are several lessons I could draw from that, but if you don't know, there was a policy, thankfully it has been defeated by the Supreme Court, that was advocated for in the state of California by someone named Kamala Harris. I don't know if you've heard of her. And it was called the FACT Act. And what Kamala Harris set out to do when she was Attorney General of California, similar to what she tried to do when she was the District Attorney of San Francisco, she set out to put an end to the work of all pregnancy centers. Elizabeth Warren, many people on the progressive side have their sights set on these pregnancy centers who they believe are fake clinics. They've spread all kinds of lies and propaganda about these pro-life centers, but I don't know if any politician has been quite as rabid and bloodthirsty as Kamala Harris, and so she pushed hard for something called the FACT Act in California. And the FACT Act, euphemistically named, of course, forced pregnancy centers in the state of California to prominently advertise for abortion. So whenever a client would walk in, like this young woman that I just described, rather than being greeted by the smiles of these pro-life Christians who were going to share with her real truth and real love, this law forced these pregnancy centers to first and prominently tell them where they can get an abortion. And thankfully, this law was overturned by the Supreme Court as a violation of the First Amendment because... That is what it is, of course. If that law had stayed put, if that law had been enforced and had essentially forced these pro-life pregnancy centers to close down because many of them wouldn't want to be in business if they were forced to advertise for the butchering of children. The story that I just told you about not only the physical life of that precious child being saved, but the saving of the eternal soul of his mother, that story would not have happened. So when Christians tell me that politics don't matter, I'm telling them that lives are on the line. Politics matter because policy matters because people matter. I often say that children are always the unconsenting subjects of progressive social experiments. Children are the unconsenting subjects of progressive social experiments, whether it comes to abortion, when we're literally physically talking about child sacrifice on the altar of the god of self, on the altar of convenience or comfort or whatever the reason is, there's never justification to snuff out the life of an innocent child. Or whether it's gender ideology that is confusing kids from a young age about their identity, their bodies, who they are, or whether it is the redefinition of marriage that forces children into motherless and fatherless homes in the name of tolerance and inclusion. These are all examples of progressive social experiments in which children, innocent children, powerless children, voiceless children, are forced to pay the price. Children bear the brunt of our policy decisions. So if for nothing else, vote on their behalf. On behalf of the protection not only of their bodies, but of their minds and of their hearts. There is this fascinating book by a man named O.M. Backe, and it's called When Children Became People. When Children Became People, it's kind of a funny title. It was actually written about 20 years ago, but it's a historical book about ancient pagan Greece and Rome and how children were treated, how they were regarded. Of course, even a progressive who may believe in abortion will tell you or will act as if children kind of have a special status. They have a status of vulnerability and innocence that we all kind of innately recognize. And it's easy to think that every culture everywhere thinks this way and always has because, of course, they're small, they're physically powerless, they are mentally still developing. So, of course, they have always received extra care and extra attention. But of course, it hasn't always been that way. When we look back to ancient Greece and Rome, children were not regarded as valuable because people were not seen as having innate value. If you look at the culture in Rome, they valued physical strength. Children didn't have that, and so until they did, they didn't really matter that much. In Greece, they counted intellectual strength as your value, or your logos, your rational ability as the worth that you brought to the table. So children were really seen as, at best, inheritors of wealth, inheritance of wealth if that was existent in a family, or they were seen as sexual objects. They were seen as unpaid labor. Many of them, if they were sick or disabled, were left out to die. Children were on the margins. They were objectified, they were dehumanized, they were seen as less than human because they didn't possess that physical strength and they didn't possess what the Greeks called logos, that capacity for reason. And Owen Bakke details what changed that. What changed the status of children in a pagan time when they were regarded as less than? Christians. Christians changed that. It was the interruption of the dehumanization that is innate in paganism by followers of Jesus Christ that upended culture and changed the world for the most vulnerable. It was Christians who entered pagan Greece and Rome and said, no more. No more are you going to trample on the elderly, on the sick, on women, on the poor, on children, on babies, because we believe in this radical doctrine of innate equality called the Imago Dei. And we believe in this radical gospel that says you are equally dead in sin apart from Christ and can be made alive by grace through faith in him. It was that doctrine, it was that belief, it was that gospel that then inspired Christians to create hospitals, to create orphanages, to take in the sick and the poor and the hungry, and to clothe those who needed help rather than pushing them into the margins of society to be seen as useless. So it was the big L logos, the word made flesh, who upended the pagan world built on the lowercase logos that only valued people based on the intellectual or physical capabilities that they brought to the table. Christians have been in the business for the past 2,000 years of changing the culture on behalf of children. Christians for the past 2,000 years have stood against degeneracy and perversion and tyranny and anything that would threaten the lives and the safety and the protection of the most vulnerable. For 2,000 years, we have stood against child sacrifice. For 2,000 years, we have stood against sexual immorality. For 2,000 years, we have stood against the breakdown of the family. And for 2,000 years, we have been a boil on the back of tyrants who would try to precipitate this degeneracy. And so, while I understand that it is not our utmost priority to be political, that's the age that we live in. What is biblical is now considered political. So when you speak up for the rights of the unborn, when you speak up for the definition of the family in marriage, when you speak up for the reality of the gender binary, when you speak up even for the sovereignty of our nation, for the enforcement of the law that punishes wrongdoing and rewards the good, you are not primarily being political, you are primarily being biblical. You are simply doing what Christians have done for 2,000 years. You are taking the baton that is being passed to you by Christians who have lived in much harder times, in much scarier times than we have now. My daughter, just a few months ago, you know, she's 5, and so she's quite the theologian. She has lots of questions, as they do at that age, about all kinds of things, about God and sin and creation and everything, and trying to understand all of that. And she was not feeling well. She had a stomach ache a few months ago. And she asked me, she said, Mommy, why am I sick? I don't know. You know, I'm sure it was someone at school, you got sick. And she said, is it just because Adam and Eve ate the apple? And I was like, yes, actually. Yes, yes it was. And she said, when we get to heaven, no one will be sick anymore. And I said, that is also true. That is also true. There will be a day when we no longer have to stand up for the lives of the unborn because we will share heaven with them. There will be a day when there's no more politics. There's no more division. There's no more partisanship. There's no more culture wars. There's no more election There's no more denial of the reality of gender. There's no more mocking of God. There's no more blasphemy. There's no more things to make our heart ache. There's no more division. There's no more sadness or sickness or sorrow or injustice or cruelty. There will be none of that, because one day Jesus is coming back, and he will rule in perfect peace forever and ever. And that is where our hope comes from. It's also where our courage comes from. How courageous and clear and forthright and bold and persistent can we be, knowing that we win, knowing that we can have a victorious mentality, knowing who will win in the end? But we're not there yet. We have time. And as I said, we have been placed in the here and the now providentially. Most people know the very famous verse in Jeremiah 29:11, "For I know the plans I have for you." You could probably all finish it. But if you look at that chapter and you look at who God is talking to, his exiles, his people in Babylon, we live in these Babylonian times. Like, even if you read fast forward, of course, but if you read in Romans 1, 2,000 years ago, the degeneracy, the perversion that was going on then, it's exactly like what is going on today. And yet the call of God's people has always been the same. So if you look in Babylon, where his people were exiles, God told him to seek the welfare of the city that I have placed you in, for in its welfare is your welfare. Well, Christians are exiles in this world. Yes, our citizenship is in heaven, but we live in this world to not only glorify God, but also take care of those around us. And one big way to do that is through our engagement in the politics and the cultural issues that affect the most vulnerable. I have another phrase that I say, because all of this can feel so overwhelming. The question is, what do I do? How much do I give? Where do I go? What do I say? How do I speak up? There's a million different answers that I could give you based on your particular life and set of skills and circumstances and resources. But here's what I always say, and here's what I remind myself. It's an addition that I made to an Elizabeth Elliot quote, but I added to it. And it's, do the next right thing in faith, with excellence, and for the glory of God. When you don't know what else to do, when you don't know how to make a difference, you just do the next right thing in faith, with excellence, and for the glory of God. Thank you.
Author and podcast host Allie Beth Stuckey, her keynote address at the Illinois Family Institute's 2024 Faith, Family, and Freedom Banquet. Be sure to attend other IFI events, including the Great COVID Con Forum, Friday, October 18th at Families of Faith Church in Shanahan, and IFI's Worldview Conference, Saturday, March 8th at Belmont Bible Church in Downers Grove. For more information, click events at IllinoisFamily.org and go to IllinoisFamily.org to donate to IFI and to order free copies of IFI's Nonpartisan Voter Guide. Please tell your family and friends about Illinois Family Spotlight. And until next time, stay healthy, stay active, and God bless.
For more information about Illinois Family Spotlight, visit ifiaction.org. And to email questions and comments, do so at feedback@ifiaction.org.